Chapter 11. Let it suffice to say briefly here, that in about a volume and a half, in which the descriptions of scenery, the account of the agonies of the Baroness, kept on bread and water in her dungeon, and the general tone of morality, are all excellently worked out, the Baron de Barbazer resolves upon putting his wife to death by the hands of the public executioner. .. 2 minutes before the clock struck noon, the savage Baron was on the platform, to inspect the preparation for the frightful ceremony of midday. The block was laid forth the hideous minister of vengeance, masked and in black, with the flaming glaive in his hand, was ready. The Baron tried the edge of the blade with his finger, and asked the dreadful swordsman, if his H-hand was sure? A nod was the reply of the man of blood. The weeping garrison and domestics shuddered, and shrank from him. There was not one there, but loved and pitied the gentle lady. Pale, pale as a stone, she was brought from her dungeon. To all her lord's savage interrogatories, her reply had been, I am innocent. To his threats of death, her answer was, you are my lord. My life is in your hands, to take or to give. How few are the wives, in our day, who show such angelic meekness. It touched all hearts around her, save that of the implacable Barbazer. Even the Lady Blanche, Fatima's cousin, whom he had promised to marry upon his faithless wife's demise, besought for her kinswoman's life, and a divorce, but Barbazer had vowed her death. Is there no pity, sir? Asked the chaplain who had attended her. No pity? Echoed the weeping serving maid. Did I not I say I would die for my lord? Said the gentle lady, and placed herself at the block. Sir Raoul de Barbazer seized up the long ringlets of her raven hair. Ow! Shouted he to the executioner, with a stamp of his foot, ow strike! The man, who knew his trade, advanced at once, and poised himself to deliver his blow. And making his flashing sword sing in the air, with one irresistible rapid stroke, it sheared clean off the head of the furious, the bloodthirsty, the implacable Baron de Barbazer. Thus he fell a victim to his own jealousy. And the agitation of the Lady Fatima may be imagined, when the executioner, flinging off his mask, knelt gracefully at her feet, and revealed to her the well-known features of Ramon de Clos Vougeot. Lords and liveries. By the authoress of Dukes and Dejuners, Hearts and Diamonds, Marchionesses and Milliners, etc. etc. I, Corblue. What a lovely creature that was in the Fitzbattleaxe box tonight, said one of a group of young dandies who were leaning over the velvet-cushioned balconies of the Oventry Club, smoking their full-flavored Cubas from Hudson's after the opera. Everybody stared at such an exclamation of enthusiasm from the lips of the young Earl of Bagnig, who was never heard to admire anything except a Caulisted in the Noël Saint Menehould, or a Supreme de Cochin and Torticolis a la Pifford, such as Champollion, the chef of the Ravelers, only knows how to dress, or the bouquet of a flask of Medoc, of Carbonell's best quality, or a gout of Marisquin, from the cellars of Briggs and Hobson. Allured de Pentonville, 18th Earl of Bagnig, Viscount Pan of Islington, Baron Pancras, King's Cross, and a baronet, was, like too many of our young men of ton, utterly blasé, although only in his 24th year. Blessed, luckily, with a mother of excellent principles who had imbued his young mind with that morality which is so superior to all the vain pomps of the world. It had not been always the young earl's lot to wear the coronet for which he now in sooth cared so little. His father, a captain of Britain's navy, struck down by the side of the gallant Collingwood in the Bay of Fundy, left little but his sword and spotless name to his young, lovely, and inconsolable widow, who passed the first years of her mourning in educating her child in an elegant, though small cottage in one of the romantic marine villages of beautiful Devonshire. Her child. What a gush of consolation filled the widow's heart as she pressed him to it. How faithfully did she instill into his young bosom those principles which had been the pole star of the existence of his gallant father. In this secluded retreat, rank and wealth almost boundless found the widow and her boy. The 17th Earl gallant and ardent, and in the prime of youth went forth one day from the Eternal City to a steeplechase in the Campagna. A mutilated corpse was brought back to his hotel in the Piazza di Spagna. Death, alas, is no respecter of the nobility. That shattered form was all that remained of the fiery, the haughty, the wild, but the generous Altamont de Pentonville. Such is fate. The admirable Emily de Pentonville trembled with all a mother's solicitude at the distinctions and honors which thus suddenly descended on her boy. She engaged an excellent clergyman of the Church of England to superintend his studies, to accompany him on foreign travel, when the proper season arrived, to ward from him those dangers which dissipation always throws in the way of the noble, the idle, and the wealthy. But the Reverend Cyril Delaval died of the measles at Naples, and henceforth the young Earl of Bagnigge was without a guardian. What was the consequence? That, at 23, he was a cynic and an epicure. He had drained the cup of pleasure till it had palled in his unnerved hand. He had looked at the pyramids without awe, at the Alps without reverence. He was unmoved by the sandy solitudes of the desert, as by the placid depths of Mediterranean Sea of Blue. Bitter tears did Emily de Pentonville weep, when, on the Lourdes' return from the continent, she beheld the awful change that dissipation had wrought in her beautiful, her blue-eyed, her perverted, her still-beloved boy. Corpo di Bacco, he said, pitching the end of his cigar onto the red nose of the Countess of de Laudimore's coachman who, having deposited her fat ladyship at number 236 Piccadilly, was driving the carriage to the stables, before commencing his evening at the Fortune of War public house, had a lovely creature that was. What eyes? What hair? Who knows her? Do you, Monsieur Prince? E bellissima, certamente, said the Duca de Montepulciano, and stroked down his jetty mustache. Ein Garchon's Mädchen, said the hereditary Grand Duke of Ehlenschreckenstein, and turned up his carroty one. El n'est pas mal, ma foi, said the Prince de Borodino, with a scowl on his darkling brows. Adieu, que ces cigars sont mauvais, he added as he too cast away his Cuba. Try one of my Pickwicks, said Franklin Fox, with a sneer, offering his gold etui to the young Frenchman. They are some of Pontet's best, Prince. What, do you bear malice? Come, let us be friends, said the gay and careless young patrician. But a scowl on the part of the Frenchman was the only reply. Want to know who she is? Borodino knows who she is, Bagnigge, the wag went on. Everybody crowded around Monsieur de Borodino thus apostrophized. The Marquis of Alicampagne, young de Boots of the Life Guards, Tom Protocol of the Foreign Office, the gay young peers, Farintosh, Poldedy, and the rest, and Bagnigge, for a wonder, not less eager than anyone present. No, he will tell you nothing about her. Don't you see he has gone off in a fury? Franklin Fox continued. He has his reasons, Sieur Prince. He will tell you nothing, but I will. You know that I am au mieux with the dear old Duchess. They say Frank and she are engaged after the Duke's death, cried Poldedy. I always thought Frank was the Duke's illicit guitquinson, drawled out de Boots. I heard that he doctored her Blenheim, and used to bring her wigs from Paris, cried that malicious Tom Protocol, whose mots are known in every diplomatic salon from Petersburg to Palermo. Burn her wigs, and hang her poodle, said Bagnigge. Tell me about this girl, Franklin Fox. In the first place, she has 500,000 acres, in a ring fence in Norfolk, a county in Scotland, a castle in Wales, a villa at Richmond, a corner house in Belgrave Square, and 80,000 a year in the 3%. Appers? Said Bagnigge, still yawning. Secondly, Borodino Louis Fate Lockhour. They are cousins, her mother was an Armagnac of the emigration. The old marshal, his father, married another sister. I believe he was footman in the family, before Napoleon princified him. No, he was second coachman, Tom Protocol good-naturedly interposed, "Cavalry officer, Frank, not an infantry man. Faith, you should have seen his fury at the young ones. I mean, when he found me in the Duchess's room this evening, tete-a-tete with the heiress, who deigned to receive a bouquet from his hand. It cost me 3 guineas, poor Frank said, with a shrug and a sigh, and that Covent Garden scoundrel gives no credit. But she took the flowers, eh, Bagnig? And flung them to Alboni, the peer replied, with a haughty sneer. And poor little Franklin Fox was compelled to own that as he had. The Mater Doddle here announced that supper was served. It was remarked that even the cowlisted in the know made no impression on Bagnick that night. 2. The sensation produced by the debut of Amethyst Pimlico at the court of the sovereign, and in the salons of the Beau Monde, was such as has seldom been created by the appearance of any other beauty. The men were raving with love, and the women with jealousy. Her eyes, her beauty, her wit, her grace, her tongue, caused a perfect furor of admiration or envy. Introduced by the Duchess of Fitzbattleaxe, along with her grace's daughters, the ladies Gwendoline and Guinevere Portcullis, the heiress's regal beauty quite flung her cousin's simple charms into the shade, and blazed with a splendor which caused all inner lights to twinkle faintly. Before a day the Beau Monde, before a week even the vulgarians of the rest of the town, rang with the fame of her charms, and while the dandies and the beauties were raving about her, or tearing her to pieces in Mayfair, even Mrs. Dobbs, who had been to the pit of the opera in a green turban, and a crumpled yellow satin, talked about the great heiress to her Dean Bloomsbury Square. Crowds went to Squab and Lynch's, in Longacre, to examine the carriages building for her, so faultless, so splendid, so quiet, so odiously unostentatious and provokingly simple. Besides the ancestral services of our gentry and vassal plate, contained in 176 plate chests at Messrs. Childs, Rumble, and Briggs prepared a gold service, and Garway, of the Haymarket, a service of the Benvenuto Cellini pattern, which were the admiration of all London. Before a month it is a fact that the wretched haberdashers in the city exhibited the blue stocks, called heiress killers, very chaste, 2 and 6. Long before that, the Monde had rushed to Madame Crinoline's, or sent couriers to Madame Marabou, at Paris, so as to have copies of her dresses. But, as the Mantuan bard observes, non cuvis contigit, every foot cannot accommodate itself to the chaussure of Cinderella. With all this splendor, this worship, this beauty, with these cheers following her, and these crowds at her feet, was Amethyst happy? Ah, no. It is not under the necklace the most brilliant, that Briggs and Rumble can supply, it is not in Lynch's best cushioned chariot, that the heart is most at ease. Ugi mi ruinerai, says Fronsac in a letter to Bossuet, sig save sua cheddar la bonheur. With all her riches, with all her splendor, Amethyst was wretched, wretched, because lonely, wretched, because her loving heart had nothing to cling to. Her splendid mansion was a convent. No male person even entered it, except Franklin Fox, who counted for nothing, and the Duchess's family, her kinsman old Lord Humpington, his friend old Sir John Fogey, and her cousin, the odious, odious Borodino. The Prince de Borodino declared openly that Amethyst was engaged to him. Cribal de debts, it is no wonder that he should choose such an opportunity to refair sa fortune. He gave out that he would kill any man who should cast an eye on the heiress, and the monster kept his word. Major Grigg, of the Life Guards, had already fallen by his hand at Ostend. The O'Toole, who had met her on the Rhine, had received a ball in his shoulder at Coblenz, and did not care to resume so dangerous a courtship. Borodino could snuff a bogey at 150 yards. He could beat Bertrand or Alexander Dumas himself with a small sword. He was the dragon that watched this palm door, and very few persons were now inclined to face a championessy redoubtable. Over a Somme d'Escargot at the Oventry, the dandies whom we introduced in our last volume were assembled, there talking of the heiress, and her story was told by Franklin Fox to Lord Bagnigge, who, for a wonder, was interested in the tale. Borodino's pretensions were discussed, and the way in which the fair Amethyst was confined. Fitzbadalak's house, in Belgrave Square, is, as everybody knows, the next mansion to that occupied by Amethyst. A communication was made between the two houses. She never went out except accompanied by the Duchess's guard, which it was impossible to overcome. Impossible? Nothing's impossible, said Lord Bagnigge. I bet you what you like you don't get in, said the young Marquis of Martingale. I bet you 1,000 ponies I stop a week in the heiress's house before the season's over, Lord Bagnigge replied with a yawn, and the bet was registered with shouts of applause. But it seemed as if the fates had determined against Lord Bagnigge, for the very next day, riding in the park, his horse fell with him. He was carried home to his house with a fractured limb and a dislocated shoulder, and the doctor's bulletins pronounced him to be in the most dangerous state. Martingale was a married man, and there was no danger of his riding by the Fitzbadalak's carriage. A fortnight after the above events, his lordship was prancing by Her Grace's great family coach, and chattering with Lady Guinevere about the strange wager. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.